chapter 1, verse 1. The title of my sermon is it's called A View from Above and Down Below. A few years ago, when we lived in Chicago, Chicago is such a great town. There's always something going on in the city, any time of year, and it was during the summer. And Sarah and I went down to, I think I was with my family too, and we went down to Millennium Park. If you guys ever get a chance when you're in Chicago to go to Millennium Park, it's really great. It's got an outdoor concert. We never got to go to a concert there, but it's got like some really wild sculptures and just a great atmosphere. A lot of people there hanging out. I wish they had something like this in Detroit. You know, I haven't yet discovered in Detroit kind of what's down in Detroit where you can just kind of hang out. And Sarah and I went to Mexican Town this past week, and it was small. It was a small little Mexican town. It was like one street. This is a Mexican town, but we went down there just to get a taste of some culture and stuff like that. But anyways, we were down in Chicago, and there was a really, we just happened to be down there, and there was a photo exhibit, and down in Millennium Park called The Earth from Above, and this exhibit was really intriguing, because it gave those who were going through the exhibit a perspective that we normally don't see. Okay, kind of we were able to. The perspective is that all the pictures are taken from the air, looking downward. All right, so it kind of gives you like a perspective that you just don't see very often. Everything is from up high. The artist, his name is Jan Arthus Bertrand. He's a Frenchman. He's traveled all over the world, every continent. So if you go to his website, there's .com and .org. You can pick on the continents, like whatever continent you want to go to, and it'll show you pictures from that particular continent of the Earth from above. Different people, different things going on. It's just a really interesting, fascinating perspective. So for example, here's just, and when he takes these pictures, he's got pictures of just different textures, different colors, really just weird stuff sometimes. Sometimes it's people, sometimes this is a patchwork of carpets in Morocco, and you can just see, one single woman just kneeling on one of them, but this is, they're making carpets there. This is a heart. This is in France, so I just took a picture. This picture's called Heart and Vaux in New Caledonia, France. And I don't know, I couldn't find what this is, but like, I don't know if this tree was, had a snowstorm on it, was struck by lightning. I don't know. I don't know if it slowly burned. I don't know. I don't get this picture, but it's interesting. At least aesthetically, it's interesting to look at. Okay, this is a worker resting on bales of cotton in Côte d'Ivoire. You know, he's just taking a rest. Looks like giant cotton balls, doesn't it? This is looking down in a country called Mauritania. Does anyone know where that is? it's in the Sahara Desert, so I think it's somewhere Asia, Africa. And it's called the Dromedary Caravan in the Dunes. So you can just see, again, just kind of what, I don't know. I know God, I don't know what God sees when he looks down on the earth, you know, but it's strange to see these textures and just a small caravan walking across the desert. This is a wheat harvest in India. This is, I don't know what this is. And that's not a golf course. There's one of New York Stadium, which is kind of cool. You can see the grass cut. I think this is like a lagoon or something. Here's an interesting one. All right, so this is in Iceland. This is near this area. There's a lot of numerous hot springs, and this is an artificial lake. All right, and the temperature of this is like 105 or so. So people are just, it's like a giant hot tub that people are in. And the blue color is a mixture of silica and chalk from the base, along with decomposing algae, which makes this kind of funny blue color. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think it'd be cool. I would go there, especially like, you know, it's 105 in Iceland. I imagine it's like cold winter. Like right now, it wouldn't be cool. Like we all got our swimming suits on and just got in here. Here's an Iraqi tank graveyard in Kuwait. So all these have somehow, the way that these are powered, or they're contaminated with like some nasty material. So like no one can actually really even go near these tanks. They can't reuse the parts or anything. But this is an Iraqi tank graveyard in Kuwait. And this is a village also in Morocco. This was built a long time ago. Originally to protect invaders. The design was like to protect invaders from coming in. But now it basically just keeps out the dust and the heat and keeps you cool and stuff like that. He had all kinds of different pictures. It's amazing. If you ever get a chance to go to his website, it's really neat. He's just got hundreds and hundreds of pictures from different continents looking down. Some are bizarre, some are strange. One is of some really cool dyes in Morocco. They got just pools of dyes. So it looks like dots looking down of different colors, blues and reds and oranges, and just really neat stuff. If you're into art, want to just kind of look at some creativity. There was one in Europe of a nude beach. And Europe is looking down. It's not erotic at all, but it's just a bunch of naked people down on this beach. You're like, man, put some clothes on, you know? It's like, what are you people doing here, you know? But it's kind of how, in some ways, when we kind of look at Luke, as you look through the book of Luke, you can kind of see God's perspective from this point of view. In the sense of God is orchestrating things. He's moving things around, moving leaders and countries and people around. He's orchestrating on a big picture. And you can see his hand working in history and changing things and moving things. All right? But the really neat thing about our God is that he's not only orchestrating history and countries and kings and presidents and people, but he also, this is from the same artist, he also deals with people on a very close level, on a very intimate level. You know, like the pictures that we saw prior, you couldn't see the people's faces or anything like that, their personality, what they were wearing exactly. But God also deals with people on a very intimate level, on a very personal level, with their personalities, their particular situations and circumstances. Another, I assume this guy's a Frenchman. Doesn't he look like a Frenchman to you? All right. So we can look at Luke's gospel also on this level, and we'll see it today. We'll see both of these kind of, this view from above, God looking down and orchestrating amazing events that are happening. But we'll also, God also deals with us or involves his hand in our lives on a very personal and intimate level. So let's take a look at the beginning of Luke. This is what he says in Luke. Many people have set out to write accounts about the events that have been fulfilled among us. They use the eyewitness reports circulating among us from the early disciples. Having carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I have also decided to write a careful account for you, most honorable Theophilus, so that you can be certain of the truth of everything you were taught. So Luke, who was a physician, he wanted to create an account, an accurate account. He says, look, I was very careful to and used eyewitness reports among the early disciples. Luke wasn't actually there when Jesus was walking around and performing miracles and doing stories. But he said, you know what, to you, Theophilus, and we don't really know who Theophilus is, but he said, for you, I've really taken a careful account. I wanted it to be very accurate. So we can treat Luke's gospel like this. Luke really wanted to make it, to get it right. And he did it for a purpose. He did it for Theophilus so that you can be certain of the truth of everything you were taught. He said, look, Theophilus, I'm writing this for you so that you can know the things that you all believe in, things that you believe in, Theophilus, the things that you've heard, the gospel account, you can stand on that. You can remain firm in it because I've made sure that the things that you've been taught, the things that you've heard, are accurate. So as we look at the book of Luke, he puts out people's names, kings' names, and dates and so forth. He's very accurate in the way he writes his account. And so like many good storytellers, Luke starts out with a little bit of background. When Herod was king of Judea, there was a Jewish priest named Zechariah. He was a member of the priestly order of Abijah, and his wife Elizabeth was also from the priestly line of Aaron. Zechariah and Elizabeth were righteous in God's eyes, careful to obey the Lord's commandments and regulations. They had no children because Elizabeth was unable to conceive, and they were both very old. Here we go, we're getting further into the story. One day, when Zechariah was serving in the temple, in serving God in the temple, for his order was on duty that week, as the custom was of the priests, he was chosen by lot to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and burn incense. While the incense was being burned, a great crowd stood out praying. So what's happening is, God is, it's kind of like, from a large picture, from kind of the view from above, God is about to begin to orchestrate. It's kind of like God is stepping up and kind of like a conductor of an orchestra, kind of taps on the podium with his baton and holds up his hands to kind of begin to move within history. And he chooses an elderly couple who have not been able to have any children. And in his wisdom, God chooses an important moment in the career of Zechariah to make his move. Okay, because as we've just read, you know, kind of talked about what was going on with Zechariah at the time. Zechariah was one of 24 divisions. There was about 18,000 priests. And more specifically, he was a member of the 8th order of Abijah. That's such a strange name, Abijah. But what is so special about this time, what is so unique about this personal time for Zechariah, was once that it was only 2 weeks out of the year that he would serve in the temple. Okay, only 2 weeks that his order would go in, his group would go in and serve at the temple. And then only one time in his life would he actually go in to do the incense or the sacrifice, and that was by lot. Okay, so that was by like throwing in everyone's name in his order and picking out his name. This was kind of a unique time, and God, sometimes his timing is perfect. All the time his timing is perfect. The setting is this: it's usually around 9 a.m. or 3 p.m. when people go to the temple and they pray one of those two times. It's the time for daily prayer set aside at the temple. And there's a crowd outside as Zechariah goes in. They're outside gathering around and they're praying. And so Zechariah goes into the temple and burns incense. And again, God is saying, okay, now is the time when I'm going to begin working on a large scale. And we'll see Luke throughout begin to see him say, I'm going to orchestrate things to bring people, to bring nations back to me. And he starts with one person. All right? He's been doing it throughout history, but this is another part of his plan. So it's kind of like, again, he's standing up, God taps it and goes, let's begin, right? So let's see what happens. While Zechariah was in a sanctuary, an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing to the right of the incense altar. Zechariah was shaken and overwhelmed with fear when he saw him. But the angel said, don't be afraid, Zechariah. God has heard your prayer. Your wife Elizabeth will give you a son, and you are to name him John. You will have great joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the eyes of the Lord. He must never touch wine or other alcoholic drinks. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before his birth. And he will turn many Israelites to the Lord their God. He will be a man with the spirit and power of Elijah. He will prepare the people for the coming of the Lord. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and he will cause those who are rebellious to accept the wisdom of the godly. All right. So God lets Zechariah in on the plan, on this larger scheme. He's like, okay, Zechariah, I'm going to include you on my larger plan through an angel. Now, I got to tell you, most of you know, and I have certainly never seen an angel. And apparently, people back in the New Testament times, early on, had never seen an angel as well. Because look, when Elijah goes in, he begins to do his regular routine or what he was supposed to do when he was in the temple. An angel shows up, and Zechariah nearly messes his pants. All right. He is like, whoa, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like. Every time we see in the Bible of an angel coming and visiting someone, I think it would kind of be cool, but every time I see it in the Bible, the person is just like, kind of fall down scared, right? Zechariah is kind of shaking in his robe. But the angel lets him in on the plan. He said, you and your wife are going to have a kid, and you're going to name this kid John. And this kid's going to give you a lot of joy, and it's going to give a lot of other people joy. And they will be excited. And the angel also lets Zechariah know that your son is going to be different. I don't want him drinking any wine, alcoholic beverages. I don't know what alcoholic beverages there were back then. But at least wine. Because this, and back then people did, you know, obviously Jesus drank wine. People drank different alcoholic drinks. But this was kind of a symbol saying, you know what? Your son is going to be set aside and your son's going to be different. And he says that the man would be filled with the spirit and power of Elijah. And again, I don't know if you guys remember this very last part of Malachi. The very last part of Malachi that we looked at, the very last section, talked about of a prophet that would be coming that would be filled with kind of, that would be like Elijah. So this is after Malachi, the book that we just looked at. There was 400 years. We call it the intertestament period. 400 years between the time Malachi ended and Jesus, John the Baptist, came on the scene. It's a long time. Again, as Luke was up here praying, he was like, hey, a lot of times we think, I wonder if the people ever got tired of waiting for this prophet that would be coming or this Messiah that was promised. Kind of similar to us when we were like thinking, hey, I wonder, it's been 1,000 years, 2,000 years since Christ was ascended. Will he ever return? But But the purposes of this new son that Zechariah would have are spelled out clearly for him. He would prepare the people for the coming of the Lord. Let's see. Do I have that up here? Yep. It's spelled out for him. He would prepare the people for the coming of the Lord. He would turn the hearts of the fathers to their children. And he would cause those who are rebellious to accept the wisdom of the godly. So it's interesting that actually one of the things that John the Baptist would do is he would turn the hearts of the fathers towards their children. Part of preparing people for the coming of the Lord was to heal kind of relationships with families. Isn't that weird? Like you'd think that, hey, Christ will come and heal, and he does bring healing. But part of even preparing for the Lord is that the family relationships would be brought together. And he would be, again, he would be like a sign, a preparation, a not a warning, but like, hey, there is somebody who is coming. In God's grand scheme, he desired to get the people's minds and hearts prepared for this coming Messiah. And we're the same way too. All of us, we want to know, we want to kind of prepare ourselves. We want to know ahead of time when something is upcoming. We work the same way. And God said, hey, I know how people are. I know how people work. I know what's best for them. I want to get their hearts and their minds ready for this. So we work kind of the same way. So John the Baptist would kind of be like a preview for a movie. You know, all of us, there's Christmas movies coming out. You know, Christmas is a big season for, I don't even know what movies are coming out. That's how long it's been since I've been in the movie theater. But you know, like all of us know, like, hey, there's some previews of Christmas movies coming up, and it kind of gives us a taste for what is to come. Or John the Baptist would be kind of like a billboard on a highway saying, hey, this is something that's coming up. This is kind of something that bends your mind towards what's going to be happening in the future. Have you guys seen these? Have you seen these? There's a number of years ago, there was some billboards out that kind of like had people think about God, you know, just kind of like God talking to you, you know. There was a campaign out. This one's, well, the road you're on, get you to my place, God. How many of you guys have seen these billboards? Three of you. Well, here's some other ones that were on the highway as you drive down. Do you have any idea where you're going? God. Don't make me come down there. God. Keep using my name in vain and I'll make rush hour longer. Love the wedding. Invite me to the marriage. God. Well, you did ask for a sign. Here it is. God. I like this. This one's good too. I miss how you used to talk to me when you were a kid. God. I like these signs because, none of them had any phone number on them or denomination or website. It was just the whole idea was it. Behind them was just to point people to get people thinking about God. It wasn't to condemn people or, you know, to point them to any denomination or church. But the one who it started out in Florida, some guy had this idea like, why don't we just put these billboards up? And they spread really. They caught on so fast. They spread around the whole United States. But you see, the larger role of John the Baptist shows the larger scheme of how God's hand, he's like beginning to shape people's minds, and God is working on a larger scale, kind of looking down from up above, and he's saying, I'm beginning to work in the world around you. I'm beginning to move this plan of mine forward on a big, grand scheme. And so, for us, it's also the same for us. God today didn't stop. I don't think he stopped during the intertestamental period. There's 400 years where, as we look at the Bible, like there's nothing, no prophets, no writings happening for 400 years. But I don't think God was like, I'm going to take a rest for a little while and for 400 years, and I'll talk to you in 400 years. I'll get back to you. It's the same here, you know. The canon, the Bible, is closed, you know. In other words, there's not going to be any scripture added to it, you know. And the Bible was, I'm not sure when it was finished writing, maybe the late 60s, before the fall of Jerusalem. So late 60s, maybe. Late 60s of, not 1960s, but 60s, like 60s, the real 60s. But, you know, that's a long time ago, right? We haven't heard, there's been no writing in the sky, nothing on the internet that we've seen since from God himself. Even these billboards, you know, they don't claim that this is from God. They're just saying, hey, this is what he might say, right? It's a long time. But hey, as you look around you, I know a lot of you don't watch the news or CNN. Maybe some of us older folks do. But as you look at the world around you and you see what's going on, you see what's happening in the Middle East, what's going on with Iraq, Europe coming together as one economic unit, kind of, it seems to be like the United States is kind of, seems to be on the downturn in my mind. Losing kind of power seems to be shifting away from the United States. Have you ever wondered, have you ever considered what is God doing now on a grand scale? Are some of these events our involvement in the Middle East, or some things that are happening in Europe, things that are happening in Africa, are some of these things part of what God is doing on a larger scale? Is he preparing us? You know, is there something that's going on even right now that God is saying, I am moving the world on a big scale because I'm preparing for my return? I mean, is he working on this scale at this very moment? Here's a quick passage to consider. And you will hear of wars and threats of wars, but don't panic. Yes, these things must take place, but the end won't follow immediately. Nation will go to war against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes as well as famines. But this is only the first part of birth pains, with more to come. This is Jesus talking about the future. He's saying, hey, this is something that will be happening, okay? Just want to let you, as followers, I want to let you in on what's going to happen, just so you're not surprised. So sometimes I look around and I think, hey, what's God's hand doing now? Have you ever considered it as you watch the news or as you look at the world around you? Have you ever wondered, is God doing something right now? Is his hand working? Is he changing leaders and moving countries and changing boundaries? And let's face it, the world is becoming smaller. You know, during World War II, when Hitler was prominent, and all the countries were going to war, people were like, hey, I think Hitler is the Antichrist, and I think this is the end. You know, this is what the Bible is talking about. And eventually, World War II passed away, and it wasn't. And so sometimes now you hear pastors or preachers saying, hey, gosh, look at what's going on in the Middle East. Look what's going on in Europe and in Africa. Is this now the end? But the difference is, we are moving in time, and our world is getting smaller. We're more connected than we ever were. Here's one more thing that must happen. For the good news must first be preached to all the nations. All right? Again, in the same passage. What's God doing right now? And can we be a part of what he's doing on a grander scale? We preach the gospel to all the nations. When all the nations have heard, it's time for him to return, right? But the cool thing is that God is not only able to work on this larger scale where he's moving within countries and moving his plan forward, like working on this kind of scale, but he's, again, he's also able to work on a very personal scale too, right? He's like, where did you get those pictures? So he's able to work in our, he's able to come down and say, hey, I'm not just out there orchestrating the world for my own purposes, and I'm gonna come back, and I only work with people only because I want to move my plan forward, right? He's not that kind of God. He's also a God that like looks in our personal lives, in our families, in our relationships, in our friendships, in our church. And so he does this as well with Zechariah and Elizabeth. The same thing that we see in the story we've seen up to this point. Like, okay, well, God's moving. He's doing something. He's starting out with a sign towards this Messiah. But he also deals with Zechariah and Elizabeth on a very personal level. A very personal level. He's like, hey, each one of you, I know you. My hand is in your lives. You may think that God has nothing to do with me, but He's working with you on a very personal level. Let's see what Zechariah said once God gets down further into like this personal level. Zechariah said to the angel, "How can I be sure that this will happen? Hey, I'm an old man now, right? And my wife is old too. You know, there's no one having kids when we're old." Then the angel said, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the very presence of God. It was He who sent me to bring you this good news. But now, since you didn't believe what I said, you will be silent and unable to speak until the child is born. For my words will be certainly fulfilled at the proper time." Meanwhile, the people are outside saying, "Hey, what the heck happened to Zechariah in there? You know, like, did he get lost in there? Is he daydreaming? Is he having some problems?" Wondering why he didn't come out. So when he finally came out, he couldn't speak to them. And I always wonder what this would look like. I mean, did he open his mouth and he was like, or was he like this? So he came out and he can't talk. And the people realized that, hey, there's something going on with Zechariah. There's something that went on inside while he was in there. When Zechariah's week of service in the temple was over, he returned home. Soon afterward, his wife, Elizabeth, became pregnant and went into seclusion for 5 months. "How kind the Lord is," she exclaimed. "He has taken away my disgrace of having no children." So Zechariah, again, on some level, Zechariah and Elizabeth are just like you and me. You know, I mean, they're just regular people. Luke says that earlier in the passage that they were righteous people. So, hey, they were following the commandments and the regulations. It didn't mean that they never sinned, but even within the regulations of the Old Testament, it dealt with sin. So they were following God's commandments. They were walking along with God, all right? But they were also righteous people that had to deal, like you and me, with disappointment. This couple, an older couple, never had a child. And, you know, many of you can't really relate to this kind of disappointment, but I tell you, we even have friends now who are trying to have kids who are not able to. And it is hard. It is hard for couples who would like to have children or just, they try and they, for whatever reason, they're not able to. So they were both careful to obey all the Lord's commandments and regulations, and not being able to have a baby wasn't a personal consequence of sin. So God wasn't like, "I'm going to punish you by not allowing you to have children because of your background of sin." In fact, they had even prayed about it. We know this because the angel said to Zechariah, "Look, God has heard your prayer." So this couple, I imagine this couple had said, "God, we would like to have a baby. Like, could you answer? Could you open up Elizabeth's womb? Can you do something here? Because we're trying and nothing's happening." And I wonder I wonder how long ago Zechariah had prayed this prayer, you know? He's probably in his 50s or 60s now. The angel comes to him and says, Zechariah, your prayer has been answered. I don't know if Zechariah was thinking, what prayer was that? You know, I mean, that was 30 years ago, God. I don't remember praying that. Let me look back in my journal. But in real life, righteous people like Zechariah and Elizabeth, who follow God, experience disappointments in their life, just like we do, you know? And God begins to work with them. Even though He's working on a grander scale, He like works with them on their level. He like sees them. He sees their disappointment. He knows their heart. And so we can kind of see, even on a very personal level, as we look at Zechariah and Elizabeth, we see them, we see kind of two kind of responses from them. And even though they're both walking with God, they're both following the commandments and regulations, we see two kinds of righteous people, you could say. And we can learn something from their walk with God and their interaction with God. Okay, on the one hand, we've got Zechariah, who raised doubts about the angel's message. All right, so Zechariah was like, yeah, how can I know if this is real? You know, how can I know if this, what you're saying is real? And, you know, I can understand, again, we can all kind of relate to Zechariah. I mean, again, he was like, dude, I'm in my 60s or 50s, you know? This is not happening. My wife is really old. And so some way you can see when Zechariah is in the temple, the angel comes before him. You can understand why he can say, I don't see this happening, God. But on another level, there was an angel standing in front of him. I mean, how many of us come across an angel in our lives? And so the angel puts a temporary restraining order on Zechariah's mouth, you could say, and he becomes temporarily mute until these things come to pass. In effect, the angel says to Zechariah, you know, just wait a while. I want you to be quiet. Zip it. And I just want... Sam was talking. She's like... I just want you to zip it. And I just want you to watch God work. All right? I just want you to watch God work. You see, sometimes underestimating God, like Zechariah did, is just as dangerous as like kind of rebelling against Him. Because in some ways, again, you're not doing anything. Zechariah wasn't doing anything overtly wrong. He wasn't living a life of sin. But he was hesitant to trust God. He was hesitant to pursue the righteousness and trust that God was asking him to. He didn't respond to God. And that's sometimes where we are. You know, we're not like living overt lives of sin like this, though we do sin. But sometimes our problem is we're like Zechariah. We have a problem, we have a circumstance, and we just don't trust Him with it. We don't trust Him with it. So, is there an area of your life right now that you're not trusting God in? Is there something that's going on in your life right now where you'd rather work on it yourselves? Sometimes, maybe the Lord is impressing on your heart to talk with someone and you just don't want to trust Him with it. You'd rather simply just let it go or not face it. So you just kind of let things go. You don't say, okay, I'm gonna step out and I'm going to trust Him. Or maybe you're the opposite kind of person. Maybe you're not the kind of person that doesn't trust God by like saying, I'm just not going to deal with it. I'm just going to walk the other way. Maybe the way that God's wired you is that you have a hard time being patient. You know, when you don't see something happening, you'd rather just take it into your own hands and control it. I'm going to make it work, right? This is how Zechariah may have been. He didn't see how this was going to happen. He didn't want to trust God in this part of his life. And so the angel said, be quiet and just watch God work. But finally, we also see Elizabeth. We see Elizabeth. She, like Zechariah, has been doing, she is also like Zechariah in that she's been living a righteous life. She's been doing what she's supposed to be doing. She's been following the Lord's commandments, but her response is different. She rejoices. She's like, oh, how kind the Lord is, she exclaimed. How he has taken away my disgrace of having no children. She's a righteous person that not only took her burdens to the Lord, but also rejoices and trusts God when those burdens are lifted. But we get a sense even from this passage that we look at, since Luke didn't mention anything about Elizabeth, that Elizabeth has been tracking along all this time. You know, even though she's been not, she was never blessed with a child up to this point, never having a kid, and it seems like that she has gotten to the point where she's like accepted it and not become bitter. Even she's experienced disappointment in her life, she doesn't become bitter. She just goes on and she just continues to serve God faithfully and trust God. So we kind of see two different, even though Zechariah and Elizabeth are righteous people following the commands, there's kind of two different responses. Because you see, God never guarantees that life will come without pain and disappointment. Right? As we see here, God's dealing with Zechariah and Elizabeth on a very personal level. He's like working. He's working his plan. They don't have a kid. He would like to have someone to prepare the people. But then he stoops down and he says, you know what? I'm going to give you that child that you've been praying for. All those disappointments that you've had in your life, I'm going to answer them. I'm going to answer those things. You may not even remember praying for it, but I'm going to help you out. I'm going to bless you. He deals with us. He doesn't deal with us. He invites us and involves himself on a very personal level. So can you see? Are you able to recognize God around you in this world? Is there something that God is doing on a big scale that He's preparing us as a people, as the world, for His return? Like, will it be in our lifetime? And can you see in your life, what is God doing right now in your life? Like, where is His involvement? Where is His hand? Because He does. He like goes, I'm not only concerned with my plan, but I'm concerned with what's going on in your life right now. Alright? Why don't we close in prayer and then we can respond in song. Father God, we just give you thanks and just praise you. Lord, you're just a great God. We just love the way that that you operate. Lord, you are so powerful that you change presidents and kings and leaders of the world. You raise up leaders and you also thwart them. You move people in and out of countries. You raise up people from humble beginnings and move them within your plan. Even the Pharaoh, who did not even want to be a part of your plan, was a part of your plan. You are this kind of powerful God who is sovereign and who, no matter what we see in the news or what is happening around us, we know that we can be secure and safe because you've got it under control. There is just nothing that can happen which is outside of your knowledge. But it is also true that you know us on the most intimate and closest level. You saw Elizabeth and her, you described it as her disgrace. Because she just wanted to be a part of the community. She wanted to have an heir. She wanted to have a child. And dealing with disappointment for her for many, many, many years. And yet, you responded to her prayer. And in this room, Lord, there are some of us now who, you are dealing with who knows what. There's something in our lives that we may be disappointed. We may be hurt. We may be angry. Heck, we may be even rejoicing. But you know us, and you are such a great God because you involve yourself with us on the most personal level. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.